Hi, everybody. My name is Cameron Munter, and I'm the CEO and president of the East West Institute in New York. Welcome to another episode of the EWI podcast, a platform where we try to dissect some of today's key global issues with leading thinkers and analysts. Today, I have the great pleasure of welcoming a good friend of mine, Ambassador Wolfgang Ischinger. Wolfgang, welcome to the EWI podcast.
Great to be talking to you, Cameron.
Wolfgang is the chairman of the Munich Security Conference and senior professor for security policy and diplomatic practice at the Hertie School of Governance, Berlin. He had a long and distinguished career as a German diplomat. During that time, he served as the German ambassador to the US and the UK, and he worked as the EU representative in the Troika negotiations on the future of Kosovo, as well as special representative of the OSCE chairman in office during the Ukraine crisis. Today, what I'd like to do is start off our discussion with an issue of great importance to you, to us, and indeed to the world, the current state of transatlantic relations. To many observers, relations between the U.S. and its historical allies are quite strained, punctuated when President Trump departed the G7 summit in Quebec. Wolfgang, how do you see the current state of transatlantic relations, and where do we go from here?
Well, Cameron, I'm afraid there is no better way for me to describe this than as a period of anxiety and a growing sense, at least, of insecurity, of doubts about the validity of principles which most of us believed were of permanent value and relevance to our relationship. So I think on the European side of the transatlantic equation, we're sort of holding our breath at this moment, because less than a month ahead, on the 10th, 11th of July, will be a NATO summit this year. And having just gone through this spectacle of the G7 meeting in Canada with some harsh words exchanged and results being questioned or eliminated after the conclusion of the meeting, many of us are worried. What if something like this would happen at the NATO summit? How would that reverberate in, let's say, places like Moscow or elsewhere? Those among our allies react who are particularly dependent on the United States. I'm thinking of Poland, the Baltic states. So I apologize for the long answer, but there is quite a bit of anxiety and concern, certainly especially strong among those of us in Europe who believe that there have always been, and there are, and will continue to be extremely good reasons to advocate a strong, vibrant transatlantic relationship. But actually translating that into practice is at this very moment a real challenge.
Wolfgang, do you think that the whole concept of alliances is under strain, in addition to the specifics of the architecture that was built after the 1940s, that we're talking about an era where, you know, the building of trust, the establishment of common ideals, that this is under fire? Do you think that Trump and the Trump presidency is kind of a signal that there's a change in international structure going on?
It certainly looks like that, Cameron. At the same time, it will need to be most strongly opposed by us on the European side than by anyone else. We are, all of us, currently 28 member states of the European Union. We are all seen from the United States, or seen from Russia, or even more importantly, seen from China. We are all small states. Germany is one of the bigger ones, but most of the member states of the European Union have populations of 10 million or less. So for them, it's been an accepted fact of life that without alliance, without strong partnerships, without the even further, more far-reaching concept of integration, of pooling resources and policies and activities, we cannot survive unless we act together. So if there is now a building challenge to the idea of alliance politics, to the idea of trust as an element of international relations, this hits Europe, I think, more than any other region in the world. No one is more dependent on alliance than we are.
So, Wolfgang, let's talk about a couple of specifics about the way that transatlantic relations have moved. The United States has decertified the JCPOA, pulled out of the Paris Climate Accords, and even recently imposed tariffs on metals from the EU. Does that indicate to you that the U.S. is moving away from Europe? Do you think this is going to pull Europe together? What are the impact of these actions by the United States?
Well, quite frankly, I think the jury is still out to a certain extent. There are these decisions and actions which you have just listed. On the other hand, when you look at what is happening on the ground in Europe, the impression one gets is less negative than these decisions regarding the JCPOA, regarding trade, regarding the G7 meeting would seem to indicate. I'll give you an example. NATO, in terms of U.S. reassurance being offered to European allies who feel threatened by Russia, etc., U.S. reassurance to these allies has actually been very solid on the ground. The United States, after having withdrawn for good reasons most of, you know, the heavy weaponry the U.S. Army used to have in Europe, has come back, has repositioned contingent in Poland, etc. In other words, there is on the ground a reasonably strong signal that the United States is doing exactly what the spirit of NATO would require and what European allies have been hoping the United States would do. The question is this going to last? I think many on this side of the Atlantic are now asking themselves the question, if President Trump has no problem raising questions or raising doubts about the United States' military presence and military activities with its partner South Korea and military activities in South Korea, is this something that could also happen to us in Europe? Is it possible that established arrangements could all of a sudden be disappearing? So that, again, is part of the anxiety that is driving us at the moment, because the smart money in Europe regards what happened in Singapore not only as an event affecting, hopefully, a more peaceful future for the Korean Peninsula, but it regards this also as a measure, as a thermometer of the way President Trump handles and takes into account the interests of allies. And my impression has been that the allies there in that part of the world, Japan, South Korea in particular, have also been understandably quite worried about the fact that they were not only not at the table, but their interests were also not specifically mentioned or raised. So are they going to be ignored? Question mark. I think this is a legitimate worry.
Is this going to pull together Europe? That is Europe going to come together, be more galvanized? And in this sense, because of the NATO issue that you're talking about, this upcoming summit, perhaps you could speculate a little bit about how Europeans look at Russia in this context as well.
Well, regarding the first part of your question, I think what one can say realistically is that the Trump administration and the decisions taken by President Trump should be understood and are being understood by many on the European side as an overdue wake-up call. It is interesting for me as a German to note that it took Chancellor Merkel, who has now been in office for more than a decade, to actually say publicly that apparently we can't assume that everything will continue in the future as it has been in the past. In other words, we need to do a little more for our own security. And this would be my words, not Chancellor Merkel's words. No one should believe that we can continue to outsource major elements of our European security to our big partner on the other side of the Atlantic. Why should America, now that European allies have grown relatively wealthy and well-to-do, why should the United States carry such a big portion of the burden? This is a legitimate question, and I think the wake-up call is overdue. Will we react sufficiently? Will we have the strength to pull together? That was your question. Well, I sure hope so. And I do hope that at the end of this month, at the end of June, before the NATO summit, President Macron and Chancellor Merkel and others at the European Union summit will actually demonstrate that they are getting together and that they are coming to joint decisions about a number of issues, including how to deal with the JCPOA, how to deal with defense, and how to deal with Russia. So to get back to the last part of your question on Russia, quite frankly, my take has been over these rather turbulent last few weeks that the decision makers in the Kremlin are seeing what is currently going on in the transatlantic relationship as a perfect opportunity to try again what Russia has tried before with not so much success in the past, namely to drive a wedge between the Europeans and the United States. The JCPOA, the fact that the United States has walked away from the JCPOA, offers a perfect opportunity for Russia to walk up to us and to say, look, we are in this together. We share the same view. We are in favor of keeping the JCPOA alive. So let's work on that together. And I'm sure there will be other areas where we can work productively together because the United States has decided to do something entirely different. So I would say that this is a very sensitive moment in the transatlantic relationship, also because anti-Americanism in Europe is having a heyday, and that the Russians are very good at trying to exploit what is for them a perfect opportunity.
In this sense, do you think that the efforts by the United States, which have, you know, shown some, I don't want to say schizophrenia, but, you know, two sides, that on the one hand, our Senate and our Congress has come out very strongly in favor of sanctions on Russia, and yet at the same time, we have a president who has shown himself not as committed to traditional relationships or alliances as he has in the past. Is this going to be confusing to our European allies? Is it a problem that America doesn't seem to speak with one voice on Russia?
If you ask me what are the three or four or five foreign policy objectives which should receive the highest attention by European governments, I would include in that list the relationship between the United States and Russia. From a European point of view, it is extremely regrettable that there is currently this blockade. I am not even going to try, because I'm not legitimized to do that. I'm not even going to try to assess whose fault is this. Is this President Trump's fault, or the U.S. Congress, or somebody else's? The fact is that U.S.-Russia policy appears blocked. And what we would like to see would be a reemergence of active U.S.-Russian diplomacy. Whether that will be crowned by success is a different story, but what we would like to see is the reemergence of a discussion between the United States and Russia, for example, about the future of the INF Treaty and other arms control and disarmament agenda items. We would like to see a proactive involvement of the United States in the stalled, so far not productive, attempts by Europeans to find a solution to the Donbass and Crimea crisis in Ukraine. I think we need help from the United States, and it would be extremely interesting from a European point of view to see that the United States is not only continuing to adopt sanctions decisions, we have always shared these sanctions decisions so far, but sanctions are one side of the coin, and trying to work with Russia in areas where maybe some shared interests could be identified, as, for example, I hope would be the case in the area of avoiding a new arms race, trying to revitalize arms control talks. And let me just conclude, Cameron, you and I are both old enough to know that even in the darkest days of the Cold War, in the 1970s and early 1980s, it was possible to conduct meaningful negotiations, conclude treaties, and have a successful arms control agenda between East and West. It is extremely worrisome that in 2018, all of this is not happening at all. And the consequences, short, medium, and long term for Europe, I think, would be extremely negative if this continues.
Now, do you believe that other places outside of America in Europe give opportunities, areas like the Middle East? Is this somewhere where America, Russia, and perhaps Europe could address some of these issues? Or is this much more of a threat, a place that could get out of control? How do you feel about those regional crises?
If I may start with the dreadful, bloody conflict in Syria, which has now been going on for more than half a decade, I happen to share the view of those who believe that it may actually be too late to rescue this country from continued destruction. But I do believe that we should try, and we should try much harder. I believe that it is not in the interests of, and cannot be in the interests of Russia, to have a hot war in the region, for example, between Israel and the Iranian militias that are increasingly being deployed on Syrian territory. Because I think from a Russian point of view, the concern would have to be that such a conflict would automatically tend to draw the United States back into the region in a way that would not be seen as favorable to Russia. So I think there are ideas and thoughts where Russia and the United States and the European Union could actually try to work together. And let me say, Cameron, I keep thinking that the formula which worked so well in the 1990s, with strong U.S. leadership, we were able to create something like the contact group on certain issues of the Balkans, Bosnia, Kosovo, etc. Or the slightly different group which we were able to establish to hammer out over a period of many years the JCPOA, these diplomatic arrangements, were actually great success stories. And I think it would be worth trying to draw Russia again into an effort to unburden also Russia from some of these conflicts, which have turned out to be very costly for Russia, rather risky for Russia, and not helpful to Russia as it apparently tries to place, again, higher priority on economic prosperity and growth. So I think there would be an incentive for the Russian government to at least explore opportunities to reduce some of these conflicts in Ukraine, in Syria, and in some of the other hotspots that we worry about. So I think we should try.
Well, Wolfgang, we've both worked in formal diplomacy, what we would call Westphalian diplomacy, state-to-state relations, but you're now the chairman of the Munich Security Conference, which we could say is a new kind of diplomacy, or at least is one of the components of a new kind of diplomacy, where new actors and new issues are discussed. Do you think that we are now, because of the difficulties we're having state to state or perhaps institution to institution, that newer and more creative efforts like the Munich Security Conference, that we may have a role to play? And do you think that's a key role in trying to get these kinds of discussions going?
I think that whether one calls it track two efforts or track one and a half efforts, but attempts to drive conflict resolution, conflict management, international diplomatic issues forward with the help of non-official diplomacy can produce meaningful input to those who are holding the responsibility of being decision makers at the state-to-state level, who are often in this current environment not capable, actually, of jumping from their boat into the other boat for domestic reasons. I'm actually unhappy that I was thinking about it, but I decided at the end it was too risky. I think I should have tried to invite some representative of the North Korean regime to come to Munich earlier this year and explain North Korean views. I think that could have turned out to be a useful contribution to what is now being unleashed in terms of an opening up of North Korea, which we hope will be a sustained effort and a continuing effort and not just kind of a diplomatic one-night stand, if I might call it that.
Well, I think that what I'm hearing you say is that track two is important, but it is most useful when it leads to track one. That is to say that it's not a separate exercise of having non-governmental groups work together, but that it's a linked exercise where the efforts by the non-governmental groups lead then to an enhanced dialogue between the people in power. It seems to me that's what you're trying to do in the work that you do, for example, in cybersecurity, which we have worked with you on at the Munich Security Conference and with EWI, trying to come up with norms, for example, in cyberspace, that the suggestions come, but it's the duty of those people outside government to contribute to discussion of those in government. Would you agree?
Yes, I certainly agree. And Cameron, I think there are, you know, new aspects to international diplomacy that didn't play as important a role 30 or 50 years ago. Let me give you an example. When it comes to the field you just mentioned, cybersecurity, we, the official diplomatic community, the governments, we need the expertise of the high-tech companies who actually know how the algorithms which govern these systems have been developed and how they function. And I find it extremely rewarding to try to bring together senior thinkers and developers and strategists from companies like Microsoft or Google, or on the German side, SAP, and other high-tech and software companies and others, to start discussing their concerns and what solutions they believe could be introduced to the track one level. And I have been impressed by the fact that one interesting suggestion that among we, the government, apparently did not come up with, at least not so far, was a suggestion that came in one of our cyber security events, where a senior representative from Microsoft suggested that what we should aim for in the norm setting effort would be something which looks a little bit like a kind of a Geneva Convention type arrangement for the cyber world. In other words, an agreement among states and companies and everybody else to outlaw and make sure that the rules are observed to outlaw activities which would harm innocent civilians. In this case, which would outlaw hacking hospitals or infrastructure elements in countries, etc., etc. So I think there is a growing opportunity for us in EWI and the Munich Security Conference and in other fora to bring together the frontline thinkers from the industry as we are moving into a world where we will be governed more and more by digital processes. And I think we have a great opportunity to confront our classic government decision makers with these people from the business community and from research institutions and universities, etc., because normally they don't actually meet all the time. And bringing them together into one room and discussing the way forward, I think, is a process to which we can make important contributions.
Well, it sounds like then, to kind of sum up our conversation, there are enormous challenges, things that we didn't foresee in past times, the transatlantic tensions that we talked about, the challenge of Russia and Russia's role, how we will deal with that, the challenge of Europe. But once again, what you've mentioned is that there are ways, creative ways, that we also didn't foresee that we can take on those issues. So it seems to me that we live in exciting times and that there are opportunities as well as challenges. So Wolfgang, I'd like to thank you very much for joining us and sharing your insights on diplomacy and on the state of the world with the EWI podcast. It was very much a pleasure to speak with you.
Well, thank you very much, Cameron. It's been a pleasure to participate with you in this discussion. And I certainly look forward to our continued close cooperation, both as individuals and friends, but also between our two institutions. It's been great working with you, and I look forward to continuing this in the future. Thank you so much.
Remember to look for us on our website, SoundCloud and iTunes under the name of East West Institute, where you can follow, listen, subscribe, so you won't miss our conversations.